Hello, and welcome to another episode of What the Kids Were Watching, the podcast about the weird, wonderful, and terrible babysitter movies of our youth. My name is still Sada. With me is still Raphael.
And I'm still on this couch with you.
We're always on this couch. We really need to vacuum it. It's actually pretty sad. Today we will be talking about a movie that I saw multiple times in the theater, a movie that feels like summer, weirdly enough, for me. This film is, in many ways, the opposite of E.T. While E.T. was about an alien that came to Earth and a boy became friends with him and hid him, and then the bad science men tried to hurt him, and then E.T. was whisked away back to his home planet. But if you're listening to this podcast, you probably already know the plot to E.T. However, this movie is about a boy who was taken by a spaceship, came back, was treated like a scientific experiment, and then, in an almost movie within a movie, has a wacky, crazy adventure with lots of funny voices and unforgettable lines for children. We are talking, of course, about the 1986 film Flight of the Navigator. I really hope that film was from 1986. Yes? Okay. Ruff, I watched this movie a lot as a kid. Like, we watched this movie in the theater several times. We brought my mom's friends and their kids, who were our neighbors and our BFFs. Shout out to Gloria, Stanley, Doug, Chris, and Mia. So yeah, this was a very, very big movie for my family, and it was a very big movie for me. I am one of those weirdos who did not like E.T. I saw it in the theater when I was like, what, 4 years old, and apparently had a nervous breakdown and was just screaming and horrified. To this day, I am frightened by white vans, which honestly I think is fair. There's something about space movies that kind of freaks me out. I've never really been into movies about aliens, and yet this film was such a staple. We watched it so many times. The bad scientist scenes are really more kind of a junior pint-sized thriller than truly scary. And then, I mean, how old were we? This came out in 1986, so I was nine. And what felt like most of the movie, when in reality it's like a third of the movie, the part in the spaceship where the protagonist and the spaceship itself, voiced by Paul Reubens, also known as Pee-wee Herman, in an uncredited role. I mean, that was just delightful. So we loved this movie. We watched it all the time. But Ralph, you didn't watch it that much, did you?
I saw it some. I remember the final third very well.
Right? Like, it feels like that was most of the movie.
I think that's what holds up in people's memories and the nostalgia about it. That said, whenever you rewatch it, it's like, oh, there's a lot of this to get through.
There's so much to get through before that, yeah. But even so, I'm struggling to think of a specific like bathroom break time other than kind of near the end when, you know, in the weird gas station. But I guess before we start critiquing the film, we should talk about the plot.
It's 4th of July, 1978 in Fort Lauderdale. And we have the young, plucky lead, David Freeman, who is a 12-year-old kid who, while going through the woods one day, falls down into...
Wait, why is he going through the woods? He's going through the woods because it's 4th of July and his family is about to go out on their boat like a perfectly normal middle-class family does. They live right by the water in Florida in this huge house and they have a boat. And David's, if I may say so, piece of shit little brother. This kid is the worst. And I say that not just as the oldest sibling, and this kid is just totally tormenting him throughout the start of the movie, and his parents are like, David, be nice to your brother. And even I am like, but he's being a shit. Anyway, so David is going to find his little brother. Then David falls into a ravine, but, you know, he gets up and...
And goes to find that the house where his family lives, they no longer live there.
No, it's different people, different wallpaper, very different decorations.
And then he discovers that he has come back and it is now 1986, 8 years later. Yeah, he is the same age and everyone around him is older.
Mm-hmm. Now, this and is... live in a crappier house. I mean, it's still right by the water, but it's clear that this is supposed to be a downgrade.
His family has spent years trying to find him. Obviously, they gave up hope. And now here he is reconnecting with the family that have gone on 8 years without him. Now, this is a really good idea. It's a good start to a story.
True. And he doesn't even get a lot of time to reconnect with them because NASA and their, in the film, evil scientists whisk him away. And they do it under the premise of, we're going to help you find answers. And instead, they find a lot more questions. Like, when they're interviewing David, all of these star charts start popping up on their screens, and they talk about how his brain is communicating directly with the computer. What looks very much like marketing material for the spaceship 3000 or whatever I mean, it really, like, watching it as an adult, I was like, no, this is clearly promotional material. These are not instructions on how to fly the spaceship. Anyway, long story short, they don't let him go when they say they're going to. He's kept in maximum security. His only friend is Sarah Jessica Parker, who is fantastic and has purple hair and talks about Twisted Sister, as with many movies.
And has a robot named Ralph.
I was just going to say, as with many movies in this area, she has a robot pal. And Ralph delivers food, so David sneaks into Ralph, gets carted out of the facility somehow, and ends up finding the spaceship, because the spaceship is calling to him. He gets into the spaceship, he's like, WTF, and the spaceship is like, whoa.
Well, he is WTFing the entire movie.
True, but no, I'm saying he's being directly addressing the spaceship as WTF. And not just what happened to me, but like, you did this to me? And so the spaceship is like, well, you only use 10% of your brain, so I filled the rest with my star charts, and I hit a power line, and I need the data in your brain to get home. So they take off, and the spaceship gets its info, I guess, like, uploads the info from David's brain, but it also uploads everybody else, so now the spaceship talks like Pee Wee Herman and is very wisecracking, and...
But he knows a lot of pop culture from the mid-80s, which David never experienced.
Does he? Like,
he's,
what?
Well, he's referencing commercials.
That's true. That's true. And supposedly he has all of David's info, but he, like, doesn't know the Beach Boys song that... First of all, this is not the only movie that I had watched as a kid that used I Get Around by the Beach Boys. I don't know why that song was so popular. I mean, it's fine, but it's like, it was used in this and Look Who's Talking, which I don't want to talk about. It was fine, whatever. I don't know. It was a movie that, you know, we watched as kids, whatever. Yeah, so long story short, the spaceship and David sort of go on this adventure trying to evade bad people at NASA. I keep saying that because things are so different now. Like, NASA is full of heroes and they do amazing, amazing work, and it's just kind of hilarious.
Don't you know, in the 80s, had to be suspicious of NASA and people in beige suits and mirror glasses.
And the government.
Yeah, I mean, we were told these were the bad guys of kids' movies.
Yes. Yay, NASA.
Give NASA more money.
Yes, give NASA more money. And it's weird that they're the villains in this film. I guess that was sort of the best they could do with a kids film, because, like, you couldn't rant about the military-industrial complex in a movie Disney made for elementary school kids. But, so, okay, so we haven't even finished the plot. Okay, so they go on this adventure, and then the spaceship is like, all right, I'll bring you back. Wait, does he even have a name? I feel like he calls him a name, but...
Max.
So the ship is named Max, which is funny because the robot in space camp was also named Max, but that's a separate episode, so I'm not going to get into how many robots named Max were very literal, and that being a point of comedy in these movies from our childhood. Max takes David back, and of course, all of the bad scientists are there, and David's like, F this, I don't want to do this. Just take me back in time to when you first picked me up. And Max is all, but Davey, you could be vaporized. We've talked about this a million times. And he's like, I don't care. I have no place here. They're going to treat me like a guinea pig forever. And I think the movie misses an opportunity to be like, also, my family has clearly suffered a lot and I don't want them to suffer. I don't want them to be emotionally devastated and financially destroyed by this. Well, anyway, so they go back in time. Max's face briefly turns into the Dianetics cover. It's very weird and creepy. And then David wakes up again in the ravine and goes home, and his family's in the boat and nothing's changed and everything's fine, except that he has this tiny alien that he brought from the ship, making them all patient zero.
To the alien contagion that will kill them all.
Okay, we'll get into that.
This movie did introduce the concept of faster than light travel and how relativity and how you don't age when you go across vast distances, because the whole point that they spend, I think, way too much time to explain is that David was taken at light speed across the universe by this intergalactic zoologist, in a sense, and then comes and tries to bring him back and just sort of screws up. And I like the idea that...
He doesn't screw it up. He's trying to keep his specimen alive, so he returns him when he returns him, but he returns him alive. So,
and he fails to return the other creature whose home planet has blown up in the meantime as well.
That's true. This program really should lose its funding.
Max is not very good at what he does, even though we love Max.
How is Max to know that the other alien's home planet was going to explode? I feel like that's knowledge that, I mean, who could have predicted that? I guess he could have gone back in time and dropped him off. Why is that never introduced?
Again, that's the thing that's sort of confusing to me. The rules are very, very flexible depending on the stakes they want to create for the movie.
Yeah, it's fine.
Now, the relationship between Max and David is really the heart of the movie. And it's fun. It's still fun. I legitimately like them talking to each other.
They're mostly just giving each other shit, which is enough relationship building, you know, again, in a movie for 9-year-olds.
It wasn't a big deal to me when I watched it as a kid. But watching it now, until David ends up having to deal with Max, who really doesn't give him any measure, he does not take his shit, is that David is obnoxiously one note.
Disagree.
And what I don't like is, while David is in a very bad situation, I have to watch him for about 45 minutes or so, basically saying, I don't believe this. I don't believe this. And it gets exhausting because we don't actually get to deal with the actual drama of his situation, because it's spending time just explaining it to us rather than letting us feel the situation, because he's always unhappy. He's always unpleasant for the whole first half of the movie, I feel, overall.
Oh my God.
Again, I get the situation needs some of that, but I feel like it's the cuppeth pour over, and that's the one beat he plays, which is disbelief or disdain for his situation, for the future, everything that's a future. Music videos are weird. The situation is weird.
He's a boomer.
Yeah, he's a boomer.
He doesn't understand anything in this new world, and he doesn't like it.
And once he deals with Max, Max is like, slow your roll. This is how it's going to go. You got to start making choices here, and we got to start, you know, doing things in order to solve this.
I disagree. I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt you for a second to say that I disagree with this assessment of Max and David's relationship. I think that David is just putting up with him because he knows this is the only way he can go home. It's not that Max puts boundaries on him and he respects them. He is totally challenging and complaining to him the entire time too, but he also, on a certain level, acknowledges that this is the only path he has.
And that's true. I do feel that there's some really good drama that we had with the family that they ignore. One of the best ideas in the movie for me is that you get the younger brother, Jeff, who's a pain in the butt as a little kid.
He's the worst.
But then he has regrets about how he acted and tries to make it up to his older slash now younger brother in the present, in 1986. Those were little nuggets of like a much better movie for me.
This is a film that I think could have been really fascinating and compelling if it was not, like, again, a Disney movie made for kids, because there is a lot of really interesting material here. How this whole incident impacts the parents is shown only by their age. Like the fact that when David sees them, he's like, what happened to you? Dude, 8 years happened. That's the aging process. The brother, it's very briefly glossed upon that this was traumatizing for him. He says, I had to put up posters with your face every Saturday for all of these years, and I can only imagine how much shit the parents gave him because he was the reason that David was sent out in the woods in the first place. His mom said, I don't want Jeff walking by himself. David, you go get him. And then David disappears. I can't imagine the burden that place, as much of a little shit as the kid is, no child deserves to have that burden placed upon him. I think there was a lot of material that would have been really interesting to explore, but I am struggling to think of a way it could have been explored that wouldn't have, it wouldn't have fit the last part of the movie. You know, it really would have taken away from this like fun adventure tone. I also just want to take a moment and rebut Ross. I can't entirely agree with you about David just being whiny. I'm trying to view this movie objectively and not just the fact that it made so much sense to me as a 9-year-old. That logic train is still moving forward, but he is sassy. Like, he doesn't need to be so rude to the authority figures, but A, you know, I mean, look at Disney Channel personas, that sort of fits. And B, isn't that like the Disney brand that kids are a little sassy?
That was later though. That's like the aughts.
Okay.
Back here, we're slap dab in the middle of the 80s, which I feel is sort of the lull.
Okay, well, think about like Goonies. I mean, those kids are pretty sassy. What year was that?
That was a year beforehand.
Okay, so, you know, I can see how they were trying to say like kids like seeing kids who are a little mouthy. And it makes sense. Not to mention the fact that, look, imagine what you were like when you were 8 or 9. If you went home and suddenly there were literally different people and your family lived somewhere else and everything was so different, you would be freaked out too. So I think his reaction completely makes sense. And as somebody who had a lot of bad medical shit happen to her when she was very young, I understand how frustrating and terrifying it is to be in this place where everyone's got wires to your head and nobody's giving you answers.
They say everything around him about what's actually going on.
They don't.
Howard Hessman is right there with him when he goes, like the star charts and stuff like
no,
that.
No, he can't hear them. There's a window between them. David can't hear anything that they're saying.
Okay, that's fair.
I mean,
that's
otherwise he totally would be freaking out. He would be like, what's that machine printing? I mean, it's clear that he can only hear the woman that he's talking to. Ha ha!
Yes, you're very correct for that scene.
I am.
I just needed a stronger relationship with the parents because the whole movie's trying to get back to them.
Also, he's 12. Like, his family is all he knows. You know, like, where else would he be trying to go? To Vegas to be a showgirl? Like,
yes.
This is all he knows.
Now this is a compelling movie for me. I mean, I don't want to beat it up too hard because there's a lot that's fun in the movie. I'm just saying the thing that we come back to it, we look at it all these years later, how do we react to it now?
I don't find him grating, and that surprises me because there are a lot of movies that feature indignant children that I just cannot with. I think that he's fine, and I like his relationship with Sarah Jessica Parker, even though it's very brief. Like, the first time they met, he kind of gives her shit about, like, her hair and how he doesn't understand why Starsky and Hutch isn't on anymore, and I like their dynamic because, I mean, obviously, like, they can't flirt because she's, like, at least 4 to 5 years older than him. It's a friendly sort of, like, brother-sister, but also they're instantly connected because they're both in this super weird environment. What I don't understand is why Sarah Jessica Parker's character, Carolyn, is willing to risk so much to give info to David's parents.
Like, and have so much access for
a high
security situation. By the way, she is one of the best things about the movie. The movie picks up the moment she comes into it.
She's great.
She's frankly what the movie is needing until Max comes in.
Yeah.
Which is just more life, more comedy, more just release for the movie. Because it's a lot of people staring ominously at things and synthesizer chords. By the way, great musical score by Alan Silvestri.
It's really fun.
The first part is just so top heavy that it needs to lighten up a little bit for the adventure that comes later.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, if you've got a movie about a kid in maximum security at NASA, whatever that means, you have to have a fun, lighthearted character guiding, you know, the small viewers through that moment.
I think Trimaxian drone ship is really cool.
It's
a neat design. It looks like sort of like a concave, like conch type of seashell look.
Where, yeah, and it's like it's a spaceship and it's a guest soap.
And I love it's early CGI.
The way it morphs into the like giant paper airplane shape, or with the pointy nose, yeah.
And the inside's this cool, shiny, shimmery.
Everything is shiny. The crab from Moana would love it. So shiny.
The movie came out in a period where it was like slap dab in the center between Star Wars movies and Batman, which would sort of change what kids' movies were. And it's in that lull period where they're like, we sort of want to do Star Wars-y stuff. So there's cute, weird aliens that are sort of like
they're
Muppets.
They're very Muppety. Yes, yeah. They are very Muppety because they're funny and weird, but they're not threatening. Even when Max says like, oh, be careful, they're hungry. And one of them eats David's NASA hat. And he's like, that could have been your head, Davey. And it's like, well, then why are you keeping them all next to each other? Why haven't they eaten one another? Muppet logic. Muppet does not eat Muppet, I guess.
Because they very much have that more type of...
Right. And they can live in... Some of them can live in oxygen, but some of them are in cages as opposed to keeping David in his own little glass cage because fairness. I don't know. Yeah, I have a lot of issues with the logic of the aliens. Not to mention the fact that David can just grab one, pick it up, play with it, and be like, you live on Earth now. I'm going to feed you the food from this planet. And somehow you will not destroy it. It will not destroy you. You're not going to eat my dog. The dog's not going to eat you. I don't know. I have a lot of... That's sort of where logic is just completely out the window. Yes, I am willing to go on the journey with the spaceship and believe that that is logical, but bringing an alien back to Earth, that's where I draw the line.
We're in a lot of bird conservation, so we're sensitive to this in particular.
I mean, I think everybody should be sensitive to the idea of introducing non-native species into the environment.
What we're saying is that the sequel to this movie is a horror movie. Here's some facts on the movie. It was directed by Randall Kleiser, the director of Grease.
Yes, and they even play You're the One That I Want near the beginning of the movie.
There are plenty of really cute little things throughout the movie. The opening...
Oh my God, the opening is the best.
And so it starts with a flying saucer, which is floating through the midday sky, and then a dog jumps up,
slow motion, grabs it in its mouth, and you realize it's a frisbee. The entire beginning of the movie is just one tease after another where you think something's a spaceship, but it's actually a water tower or the Goodyear blimp or something. But yes, and there's even like creepy music as the spaceship is floating past all these buildings, and then dog! Yeah, so we open the movie with the Fort Lauderdale championship for who's a good boy. This kidding, it's actually like a dog frisbee grabbing championship. And apparently the dog, he looks like an Australian Shepherd, the dog that David has, is named Bruiser, and Bruiser is not great at catching the frisbee yet. I guess Bruiser is supposed to be young, though Bruiser does not age throughout the movie. And we get, in the first 4 minutes alone, David's little brother dropping the R word, insulting the dog, because late 80s. That's very uncomfortable. Really, Disney? Thank you.
Now, I've spent a lot of time in Florida.
Humble brag.
That's not humble brag.
He really hates it. Sorry, Florida. You're very pretty in parts.
You're very pretty and you're very nice during certain seasons. I can't handle the heat or humidity and all that. They get a lot of little details right about Florida. Because there's a part where David just pulls out a box of fireworks and are you kidding?
It's the biggest box. And his dad just sits down next to him on bed. They're talking about like how to talk to a girl. Huge box of fireworks at their feet. And I'm like, that's just in the kids' room. Not a big deal. Fine.
And that's Florida. That is Florida. They have fireworks. They are legal in the city. And family have done that. So maybe not be in the kids' room, but having that many fireworks is very, very common.
What's hilarious is at the end of the movie when Little Big Jeff uses the fireworks to signal to David where the house is, because, you know, no GPS, it's 1986. It looks like the same fireworks from 8 years ago, and they still have them, and they still work, and that's funny.
Well, they're Chekhov's fireworks.
Yeah, fair.
I really love this late 70s fashion of the movie before we get to finger quote present day. It looks like the family spent all of their money to try to find David and thus are in a poorly shingled house.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not ever really called upon, and honestly, I didn't even really notice it as a kid. As an adult, there are little signals that they've gone down in class. Like their old house was very big, very pretty, literally right on the water. There's lighting outside. And then in the newer house, when the cops pull up with David, none of the lights are on. Dad's walking around in a bathrobe, still right on the water. But these seem to be subtle signs that things are not as good for them as they were. And of course, you know, his parents have aged and mom's got her hair pulled back way hard. And like everyone, like they don't have to do aging process on them because they've tried to make them look as old and worn down as possible. And I mean, they don't look that bad.
Yeah.
As a 43-year-old, I'm looking at them and I'm like, y'all, just get some moisturizer, put on the sunscreen. You're fine. You're fine. You don't look that different. But, you know, as a kid, I get it.
This was one of the movies made in the Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg era where they were... There's a lot to say about that, and there are plenty of podcasts and web series about it, so we're not going to go too deep into it.
I do recommend Defunctland. I love... Side note, it's not an ad, not sponsored. I love Defunctland. So well done. I've only listened to a few episodes of the podcast. The ones I've listened to were great. The YouTube series is amazing. It's very well done. It's very well researched. It's very funny. It calls out a lot of bullshit. And for what it's worth, when my dog Verona was dying, I basically rewatched Defunctland like 4 times because the narrator's voice, Kevin Perger, just really seemed to soothe her when she was very anxious. As if Defunctland wasn't awesome enough, it also helped my dog through her last few months. That being said, Defunctland is great. A lot of good info about the Eisner and Katzenberg era then that feels opinionated but not super biased. It's very well researched. Check it out.
This is one of those movies that was made under the Katzenberg, let's make something cheap that everyone will like type of movie.
Yeah.
It was not an expensively made movie.
I was going to say, but even the spaceship, all that shiny takes dollars.
It does, but notice how it's just that one spaceship. Mm. If you look at everything that is not inside the spaceship, it looks sort of...
That's true. It's like we get a warehouse, we get an office space, we get a couple of houses. Exteriors, we get a hospital room, and then the woods, and that's pretty much all the exteriors.
And then with the
Al's Gator Farm, but I mean, how hard is that to find in Florida?
Not very hard.
Bless your heart, Florida.
They were clearly putting all the money in the computer graphics and the animatronics of the Max head, which is really cool.
It's a puppet, yeah.
And then the little Muppet aliens. And that was sort of the focus. They're going, we're going to get the little kids with this movie. And I sort of think of this as the 80s equivalent of That Darn Cat, Cat from Outer Space type of thing. It's updated to more modern sensibilities of the time, but I think they scaled it in that sense.
I would disagree with you about The Cat from Outer Space and to an extent That Darn Cat, because those movies seem to be more based on people misunderstanding situations or missed connections, or it's more sort of like situational and funny, but kind of the same mistake over and over, which is why I'm very bored by that kind of plotline. Kind of bores me. And this movie isn't, like, the premise of it at the heart isn't a comedy. It is a comedy, but the idea isn't like, oh, we keep, you know, missing each other or making these goofy mistakes. But I see what you mean as far as it is a fantastical concept executed with a budget.
I think they would have been perfectly happy to have, oh, we'll have a few more of these movies with the navigator, with the ship, and with like a new navigators. I could easily see that type of thing, because ironically, Paul Rubens after this ended up doing the voice for the robot in Star Tours, which became a big ride the very next year.
Yeah.
And it is sort of the same thing. It's, you're going all over the Star Wars galaxy with this vaguely incompetent robot that's sort of
Max
making a mess of things.
Max is not incompetent. I mean, he's not incompetent. He's human, which is funny because he's a robot. He makes mistakes. He runs into an electrical tower.
Looking at some flowers.
Was that a joke or was that real?
I think it was real.
He collects specimens. This is literally what he does. Yes, he says, I was looking at some daisies. But he was probably examining specimens, deciding whether to take them back.
I don't put the idea down. The movie makes fun of the fact that he was looking at flowers. I think that's great of him.
I think Max is fallible, but I also, maybe he was version one. Maybe he was like a prototype. I don't know. We can build him better. I like Max. I feel for him.
Oh, he is my favorite character in the movie, without a doubt.
I don't know. Maybe it's like the first couple of seasons of Star Trek where he's out there. He's doing his thing. He's kind of figuring it out. He'll write some best practices of how to avoid vaporizing your humans and hitting electrical towers and stuff like that. Okay, so there are so many like goofy lines in this movie. I have to say that I learned an important word from it, and that word is compliance.
Compliance.
Max says compliance all the time. It's his affirmative. It's his yes. To the point where anytime I deal with software or technology and the word compliance comes up, part of me will always think compliance, like a goddamn robot from the 80s. So yes, these movies are fun for lots of reasons, not the least of which is that you learn useful new vocabulary words. So I'm drawing a blank, and I hope that Ralph will jump in and tell me, but I'm thinking about the trope in the late 80s of like kid has adventure movie. And what I think sets this film a little apart is that the stakes are so big and so real. I don't want to compare it to Goonies. I mean, because the stakes there are very big. They're trying to save their house. The stakes here are, this is his whole existence. His family has been devastated. His life is gone. He is in a world where not only does he not know anything and he's 8 years behind, but he's going to be, in a way, persecuted as a science experiment for the rest of his life. So his reason for risking death to go back in time to where he initially was, I mean, that's kind of a big deal. And I think that that's what sets this movie apart from a lot of the other films of the era. And I'm really hoping Ralph will jump in and be like, no, it's actually very similar to X, Y, and Z. Yeah, that's what I think I found really compelling about it as a kid. The stakes were enormous, and yet it still managed to be really fun, which you don't always get in films where the stakes are this high.
There are several, not many, movies that are like this. There's a movie called Daryl, which
I never saw that.
Which ironically starred the same child actor, little Joey Kramer.
Oh, I thought he was so cute when I was like eight, nine, ten? Yeah.
And it was this period of child adventure movies through this early, mid, sort of like 82 through 86, 87.
Let's not mistake it. These are boy adventure movies.
Very much so.
Yeah.
There's a whole slew of them in terms of there's Daryl, there's Cloak and Dagger, there's of course...
I did not like that. Ralph made me watch it. I found it very sad.
Of course, Goonies, which is probably the most popular of the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's Neverending Story, of course, which is more fantastical. This one is closest to Daryl, except Daryl is more of a straight-up drama.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably the one that sort of uses a mixture of tone where the first half is serious, the second half is light and fun.
Not even second half, like last third.
That third.
Yeah.
And it's using this very high science fiction concept mm-hmm. of relativity and such, like serious sci-fi stories would cover,
mm-hmm.
but it does it in a very child-friendly way.
Yeah.
And that's the most unique aspect of the movie, because everything with Max is really the most obvious part, because it's the boy and his robot.
We will also be talking about another boy and his robot story in this season, Space Camp.
Now, you said something really interesting, which is...
Tell me about it.
The boy and his robot is really an extension of a boy and his dog narrative.
Yeah, I said that yesterday. The boy and his dog trope has always been big for decades in kid lit, in YA, because it caters to the boy market. Those are stories that are marketed towards boys, towards young men. I mean, obviously, like everybody reads them and enjoys them. To some extent, like everyone knows the story, Old Yeller. But yeah, boy and his dog stories are very big. And I think that was translated in the 80s into Boy and His Robot Stories.
Or Boy and His Alien was the other sub-genre.
Yes. That's how it morphed into the high-tech craze of the 80s.
86 was the year that we had Short Circuit. It was the year we had Space Camp, and we had this all in the same summer.
Short Circuit was more of a man and his robot, but I get what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very much sort of the crux of the fantasy.
Yeah.
And even Rocky IV in the same year, Rocky had a robot. There's a robot.
Okay.
It's Polly's.
Do I need to rewatch Rocky IV?
No.
Okay.
It's fun. It's the most 1986 movie ever made, but you don't need to in this context. And so there was just this obsession with technology. And one thing I do appreciate, the movie really wants, sort of appreciates science, appreciates the idea of exploration.
It does not. It casts science as the villain. It casts discovery as the villain. It casts research and trying to figure out a problem as gross and invasive and horrible. Now, I admit that that's because the bad scientists in this movie have no transparency with David and his family.
I think that's the mistake of the narrative. But I'm talking about Max is also an explorer. He's also in a sense.
But you're the one who also says that he's incompetent. So he does it, but he's not great at it. And look at what happens in the process. He destroys his kid's life. He has this other alien whose planet was destroyed, and so he can never get back home. So I guess one could argue that that's actually good for the alien because he wouldn't have survived it. It does paint exploration and scientific discovery as not great. You know, then it becomes kind of fun, you know, once the human comes in and makes it sassy and puts Beach Boys tunes to it. I don't know. I'm wondering if it's pro-science or anti-science. I really hope it's pro-science. But NASA is just painted in the worst possible light.
Well, what's funny is that I think the sin that NASA does in the movie is they just don't communicate with the parents and they keep them longer. But the story doesn't even make it an active on-camera thing.
It is one scientist. It's Faraday, who is played by Howard Hessman, and he's great. He's threatening without being violent and without being creepy. He's just frustrated. He's a middle manager. He's like a really gruff Lumberg. You're going to come in and stay Saturday, and that's just how it is. He lies to David's parents when David's escaped. He's like, oh, well, he just didn't want to talk to anybody right now. He manipulates them to get them to agree. I think what could have made the film more compelling is explaining his reasons behind it. Like, is he just a shitty person? Is he just trying to rise up the ladder? Is he also very curious and concerned about David? Or is he just like a bad apple who somehow got into this leadership position?
Well, they don't clarify. Because he could go one of two ways. What if David's actually an alien? What if David, I mean, there's all these things that David could be a threat to Earth.
Right. Even. And then, well, what does he stand to gain by keeping David there? Again, is it like, is he trying to help the planet? Is he trying to help people? Is he trying to help David and his family? Or is he using this for some kind of selfish gain? Is it altruistic? I don't know.
But we don't know that.
Yeah.
It's vague is how I would describe it.
Yeah.
It has lots of neat ideas, but it's just vague. Mm-hmm. About the characters in it. It's vague about the drama between him and the family, mm-hmm. him and the scientists and such. It just has him, just the disbelief note that they keep playing in the movie.
So since I've only seen E.T. once in my life, and obviously it was traumatizing, how similar is Faraday to the scientist in E.T.?
The scientist is treated initially very threatening and impressionistically. He has this sort of Peter and the Wolf music, and he doesn't have any dialogue for the first two-thirds of the movie. He's just represented by a flashlight and these keys on that jingle on his belt.
Okay.
So he's scary impressionistically from a kid's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
When we finally see him up close, he's a surprisingly benign and polite person who's been searching his whole life for aliens, and he actually has a lot of compassion for Elliot. He sort of tells Elliot, I'm glad you found him first. I'm sorry we can't help this alien, because they try to do everything they can to save E.T.,
mm-hmm.
but they can't because he's been on Earth for too long and it's killing him.
Mm-hmm.
But then once the kids try to rescue E.T., Keyes does not reveal that he knows where the kids are going. So he lets E.T. get away being inactive.
Mm-hmm.
But the plot's not about him, so it sort of does it in a very simple shorthand.
So it sounds like he's a more complex character and more compassionate.
With far less screen time, too.
Mm, interesting.
And it's part of why I think E.T. is a much better movie. Everyone in the movie is far more nuanced than this film. And it's not that it couldn't be nuanced, because I think the cast is really good in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just, we got a movie, we got to get it out.
It'll play on our new Disney Channel. When was the Disney Channel launched?
A little bit before then, but
it lines up. You know, like, this is a thing we can release in theaters, and then we can play it ad infinitum on TV. It'll be great. Parents won't complain because it's not super scary. It's got, you know, Muppet aliens.
Feels very Disney Channel-y now that you say it.
It really does, yeah. So ultimately, I would say, I don't know, I would say I would recommend this movie. I would say that again, I don't have kids, so it's hard for me to say, show this to your children. But I think that it's fine. It's not fantastic. Like I said, it's like we both said, there are things about it that are thin and not that great. It's pretty benign. Out of all the babysitter movies I had, it was probably the most competent. It was one of the most competent. It did its thing. It didn't traumatize me. It was fun. It taught us some one-liners that we still know. So, I mean, I think it's fine. I think if you want to revisit it, I say give it a shot. It's on Disney Plus, which, you know, if you have it, fine. It reminded me of the joy of going to a movie together with my family and seeing something that we all genuinely enjoyed. And seeing something with my mom's friends and our friends where we all enjoyed it. And honestly, I think that's what I love the most about this movie, the fact that it became something that we loved and that we all found something to love about in it. And not every movie from my youth I can say that about. I'm trying not to let that cloud how I feel about it. I hope I have been pretty honest and mostly objective. For better or for worse, for me, Flight of the Navigator will always remind me of being with my mom and my younger sister and brother. And my mom's friends, Gloria and Stanley, and their kids, all of us just hanging out together and having a really, really happy time. It's interesting that we're doing this movie now. This is the second podcast we're recording since my mother passed after a long illness. I know I lean towards nostalgia a lot. And I have to say, revisiting this and thinking about it and remembering like that joy that it brought us, and the fun that we had watching it and rewatching it and re-rewatching it. But remembering that's been pretty fantastic. In a way, I feel like Max has briefly transported me back to that time. And man, I'm really grateful for that. So, with our sassy robot friends and aliens who hopefully are compatible with this planet and trying to read our own star charts to plot our own way home, this has been Sada and Ruff, and that was what the kids were watching. Compliance!
What the Kids Were Watching has been produced and hosted by Sada Ruiz and Rafael Ruiz. Theme music provided by Pete Seibert. For more information on our podcast and to read the companion blog, well, really more of a cartoon sidekick, you can go to whatthekidswerewatching.com. You can also find us on social media. Look for What the Kids Were Watching on Facebook, What the Kids Were Watching on Instagram, and What the Kids Were on Twitter. What the Kids Were Watching.
Copyright 2021, RAR Works, LLC.